To the left-hand side for Vieira, who'll play through to Gabriel Jesus, who's in here for Arsenal. Gabriel Jesus to finish it off. Oh, what a way to do it! Gabriel Jesus seals the points for Arsenal. He's back, and he's back with a bang.
Into the penalty area it goes. Gabriel header, and it's into the back of the net. Arsenal take an early lead through Gabriel.
You're listening to the Chronicles of Aguna, the daily Arsenal podcast with me, Harry Simeon.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back to another episode of the Chronicles of Aguna podcast with me, your host, Harry Simeon. And I'm delighted to say that joining me on this episode is a Chronicles of Aguna legend. He goes by the name of Mickey Stavrou. It's been a while, Mike. How you doing, mate? Good to see you.
Hello, mate. I can't lie. I've not seen that new intro. I was blown away. Bloody hell. You've come a long way since the Martin Tyler days. How long have you had this one, new one for?
It must be maybe 2 or 3 months now, I think. Okay. Someone very kindly synced up my BBC Radio London commentary to that video of Gabriel Jesus scoring that goal. So I took the video as I was doing it, but obviously you can't hear the commentary just like that. And somebody very kindly synced it up for me. And so I thought, why not use that?
Looks good.
Thanks, mate. How have you been? Because it's been a little while. You're a very busy man, very difficult man to pin down these days.
Yeah, all good. All good, man. Just been working hard. I'm not doing the Spurs podcast anymore. Everyone on this platform will be happy to hear.
That's a bloody relief.
So I'm doing the main Athletic FC podcast. So I get to work with incredible journalists on a daily basis, like David Ornstein, all the Arsenal people, but all of the other amazing journalists we have as well. So yeah, I'm really, really enjoying it. I'm still overlooking the Spurs pod, so you know, I get to have a laugh when they when they lose, but from a further distance. So yeah, all good, man. All good.
We'll be expecting some exclusives over the course of the summer via David Ornstein through Mike Stavrou onto here. Brilliant stuff. Mike, look, we're going to do a little bit of an audit of the Arsenal squad here today. And I say audit of the squad, but we're not going to go through every single player because there are a lot of players that there's not even, you know, any point in having a conversation around where their futures lie, right? The likes of Bukayo Saka, Martin Odegaard, Gabriel Saliba. These are all players that are a big, big part of our team right now and that we want to keep and that we want to move forward with. But I've picked out a few names of players that, you know, there's probably conversations, I would say, ongoing, at least within the fan base, with regards to whether or not they're players we should be persisting with, we should be looking to cash in on, we should be looking to move on for other reasons. We'll get into all of that stuff. So we're going to go through five players. Those players are Emile Smith-Rowe, Thomas Partey, Gabriel Jesus, Fabio Vieira, and Jakub Kivior. Those are the five I've picked. If there's anyone else that you want to throw in, feel free to do so. But before we dive into that, I want to get your thoughts on the title race because we haven't spoken for a little while. How are you feeling about it? I said it on this show the other day. I've kind of resigned myself to the fact that we're not going to win it because it's out of our hands and I'm protecting my emotions. But I'd be lying if I said there wasn't a little bit of hope and there wasn't a little bit of desperation, actually, to see Arsenal get over the line. How are you feeling about what remains of the Premier League season?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of just taking it as it comes because I think I learned a lesson from last season. And we can talk about how much the team was emotional, but like the fan base was so emotional because we hadn't seen them in that position in such a long time. I mean, the year that Leicester won it, we went close, didn't we? And then we faded away, but it didn't really feel like it felt now because that felt like a kind of one-off. That season, you know, a lot of the top clubs were shambolic. And, you know, there was a few moments where you thought, oh, maybe we could. But last season was different because I think we were in it for real for the first time in a long, long time. And I think that stirred up a lot of emotions in us. Because of it had been building to that point, right? Like we'd been saying on the pod that things are moving in the right direction. They've reset the culture. There's players there that we really sort of connect with. And, you know, it was everything about bringing the fans back together after the last few years of Wenger, which really ripped us apart as a fan base. So it was a bit of a surprise that we were in that position, given that we failed to finish in the top four the season before. I think this time around, we're a bit more used to it. We know we're a top team. We can see it with our eyes. I think we're getting a lot more respect from people outside as well. The media, but all sorts of places, they recognize that we're a good team. And even though they try and bring us down a few pegs by saying that we might bottle it and stuff like that, I think they know that we're a good team. So this season I've been a lot calmer. And I'm just enjoying it. I'm trying to enjoy it. And I know it's so difficult because we're so close. But I think that, you know, after the Aston Villa result, as long as we could say to ourselves that we didn't fall apart, which we've not done, we've bounced back really well from that. I think we've done all we can do. And if Man City can go on and win all of their games like we expect them to, we've done all that we can. I feel like there's that kind of, like you say, resignation that we're up against a juggernaut in Man City, and it's extremely difficult to get the better of them. Just ask Liverpool from a few years ago. So as long as we do our part, then, you know, what else can we do, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, you know, and I keep saying I'm kind of resigned to it, partly because I think that if I'm predicting with my head rather than my heart, that's probably what's going to happen. Manchester City are going to lift the Premier League trophy. I can't see Spurs doing us a favour. I can't see West Ham, who have seemingly checked out at the moment, doing us a favour on the final day. And I certainly can't see Fulham, who were flying kites in training yesterday, you know, bringing Manchester City down a peg or two. And I also can't say with any degree of certainty, just because of how bad our record's been there over the years, that we're going to go and win at Old Trafford. So how could I sit here and say, you know, we're definitely going to win it? I can't say that with any degree of confidence. But I think my expectations at the start of the season were probably a bit different to most people's, in that I didn't look at it and go, well, we finished second last year, so the only way that we can progress is to go and win it the following season. For me, it was first and foremost, get ourselves back in the Champions League. You've got to be a Champions League side consistently. You can't just get in there once and then disappear again for a while. You need to be in there consistently to rebuild that status, to bring in the finance consistently over a period of time that allows you to compete with the very best. And I said that I wanted us to maintain the level that we hit last season, which was a title challenge. And I would argue that even if we don't win it, we've gone further in the title race this year than we did last year. And we've done that whilst balancing it with Champions League football as well. So I think we've definitely progressed. And progression isn't always linear. Like, you don't always go from here to there. Sometimes it flatlines a little bit before you can take that next step. And the next step is the hardest step to take. The step of actually pipping Manchester City and Pep Guardiola to the title is the biggest one. So if that doesn't happen this year, if I take into consideration everything else, I'm not going to sit here and say this season was a failure. But I don't think, Mike, that everybody will see it like that.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, outside noise is not something that we can really control. I mean, I even saw something on social media recently, and it was like, you know, Mikel Arteta, 5 years, one trophy. And I think that looking at it in such a binary way removes all of the context. I think you have to look at the club that he inherited, how much of a mess we were, the sort of regeneration that's happened on and off the pitch. As I mentioned earlier, the sort of culture war that was happening within the fan base, you know, there was so much damage there that you have to look at it as a project. And I guess you can say, you know, to some extent, maybe there were times and, you know, we came on this podcast and spoke about it, that it wouldn't have been the wrong decision at the time to say, okay, you know, Mikel, thank you, but this is a job too big for you, given that you literally had zero managerial experience before he took over. But the fact they stuck with him is testament to them, to their belief in him and their belief in that project. And I think that when you look at it as another season gone by and no trophy, I think it's diminishing all of the great work that's happened. And I agree with you. I think we are building towards something. And like I mentioned earlier, sometimes the progress is going to jump up a step. Like no one expected us after, you know, that horrible feeling of missing out on the top four in the way we did, you know, losing to our rivals, Spurs, and then that capitulation at Newcastle. Like, no one expected that we'd bounce back like that in the following season. You have to look at everything in context. And look, like, once Pep goes, it's a different conversation. But right now, we've got one of the greatest managers of all time managing a squad that will, you know, go down in history. They are one of the best squads in the Premier League era, if not all time. So you have to look at it in that prism. And really, you know what, Harry, the thing it is for me is that I'm just proud of what I'm watching week in, week out. I mean, I've not watched a team as good as this. You know, I was quite young when it was the Invincibles. I obviously do remember them. But since that team, really, and maybe about from 2006 onwards, when that team started to break up, I've not seen an Arsenal team this good, this resilient, and that I connect with that much. You know, I love I love the squad, and I love what they represent and how they connect with the fans. And, you know, I think if you don't end up beating Man City, this huge juggernaut, then, you know, it is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree. Let's get into some players then. We're going to try and do this in a kind of start, bench or sell format. Now, I know not everybody can start because, you know, it's a squad game nowadays, right? So there will be some rotation, but there'll be players that we can put in the category of good enough to start. Let's kind of frame it that way. Only good enough for the bench or somebody that we need to move on and sell. Before we dive into these names, if you haven't done so already, please do leave a like on the video. If you're watching us, make sure you're subscribed to the channel too. If you're listening on audio, then please do leave us a review as well. That really, really does help. We're going to dive into player number one right after this very, very brief pause. Okay, player number one in our game of start, bench or sell is Emile Smith Rowe. Now, this is a player, Mike, that when he first broke through, I was super excited about. This is a player that I thought had the potential to go on and become an Arsenal legend. And I still think the talent is there. I still think that, you know, if you were once that talented, then you'll always have that talent. The question is, can you go up to the next level with it? But other factors for me with Emile Smith Rowe have caused him to stop in his development. And he's in a place now where I don't really know where he fits in the future of Arsenal Football Club. The first kind of angle I'll come at it from, and I'll throw this over to you, is what's his best position? Because I think only when you know what his best position is, can you figure out whether or not he has a future in this team and at this football club? Because I can't quite put my finger on it. What for you is Emile Smith Rowe's best role?
I don't know. I don't
Says
know.
It all.
I think his best games for Arsenal have come as a number 10, where he has less defensive responsibility. But the plain fact is that we've evolved away from that system. We don't play with a number 10. So really the next closest position you're asking him to play is as the more attacking number 8 next to Martin Odegaard. But that position comes with a lot of defensive responsibility. Maybe that's why Kai Havertz isn't featured there as much as maybe Mikel Arteta would have wanted him to when he first signed him as the player sort of coming in to replace Granit Xhaka. So I guess you're sort of toying between number 10, which is a position that has kind of become, you know, it's come out of the game really, hasn't it? In the modern game, I think we can agree with that. And then you're looking at left wing. Do I think he's explosive enough for that position? Do I think he's tricky enough? Is his final ball good enough? I've not really seen him there enough, to be honest, to say that. So I think out of those three, left wing, 10 and 8, I would say 8, but the plain, you know, fact is that we've not seen him there enough to be able to convince us that he can do it. I think, to my knowledge, he started 3 games this season. I remember I was at the Luton game and he started in the left eight there. I thought he had a decent game, to be fair, but it's against Luton. So it's hard to judge. But yeah, position wise, I would say eight out of those.
Eight. Okay. So yeah, I mean, this whole thing about him becoming an eight or sort of adapting into that eight role, I think is a little bit of a strange one. And I think you have to kind of unpack it in a number of ways, because first of all, I don't think if we played with a number 10, the idea of Smith Rowe playing an eight would even be a thing. I think what people have tried to do by labeling him as an eight is say, well, we don't have that role in our side. We probably think that is your best role, but seeing as we don't utilize that particular area of the, or we don't have that sort of player, we're going to shoehorn you into another role. Now, the example that people would use is the example of Martin Odegaard, who came in and we all looked at him and went number 10, and he's moved and transitioned into an eight, but he's obviously got a lot more license than your average eight. But I think the bit that people maybe miss with Martin Odegaard is that he's more than happy to get stuck in and do the defensive stuff as well. His physical level is incredible. I don't feel that with Emile Smith Rowe. So this idea that Emile Smith Rowe can go from a 10 to an eight and that be fine, it doesn't quite sit with me right. I have to say that. I don't think, if you go back to the start of the season, right, when we were without Thomas Partey and Declan Rice had just come in, there was a reason that Mikel Arteta kept picking Kai Havertz as the left eight, outside of what he gives you on the ball and outside of his ability to make runs from deep. Do you know what it was? It was the physicality aspect. The idea of going into a game with Rice as the base and then Odegaard and either Smith Rowe or Vieira, quite frankly, I thought scared the living daylights out of Mikel Arteta, because the physical requirements then from Declan Rice are ridiculous. To put that pressure on him and say to him, you have to carry two players that aren't, you know, big and strong in the midfield, is going to really increase your workload, and actually it might do you damage and impact your performances. So I think the fact that Mikel Arteta was more than happy to go with Havertz over either Vieira or Smith Rowe says a lot about those two players and whether or not Mikel Arteta trusts them and his, I guess, obsession with finding the right physical balance in the midfield as well. So to kind of summarize on Emile Smith Rowe, for me, it's sell, because I don't know where he fits in. I agree with all of your points about him playing on the left wing, not explosive enough, isn't going to run in behind as much as maybe Martinelli does, isn't the cold-blooded goal scorer that Leandro Trossard has shown himself to be. I think sell is the right thing to do. Factor in that he's homegrown, factor in that he's an English player, that probably brings you a little bit more money, whether people like to admit that or not. Injury record, though, it is a problem. So if you were a buying club, Mike, how much would you be willing to drop on Emile Smith Rowe? Because there is an element of risk to it.
Yeah, I think as well, Harry, you can't rule out with this sort of discussion the emotional aspect and the attachment that we all have to the academy players. And because Smith Rowe did have them highs, and someone mentioned in the chat earlier, he saved Arteta in the... Yeah, there you go. Saved Arteta in the lockdown period. I mean, I remember that game specifically on Boxing Day when I think it was... him, Martinelli, Saka, and maybe Eddie that started up front. And it was like, we were in a dire position. It looked like Arteta, if he didn't get a few wins at that time, was going to go. And we managed to beat Chelsea. And Smith Rowe, probably one of his best games for us. So we all have that sort of attachment to him where we think, wow, this kid has come through the ranks, was really impressive at the youth levels. He was doing something on Arsenal Twitter the other day where he was reviewing one of his goals, and it was an unbelievable goal. Like, curled it right into the top corner from the edge of the box. And you see that he's got all the talent in the world. But as you say, talent is not enough. You need that hard-working element to it. And I just don't think he has that to that level. I always think in football, you always have to sell at your peaks. So I look back at Joe Willock when he went on loan to Newcastle. And he had that unbelievable spell. We sold him at the right time. If he would have come back to Arsenal, which some people wanted, by the way, and had a year where he didn't really play, was in and out of the team, we wouldn't have got, what was it, 35 million, I think we got for him,
yeah,
something
exactly,
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
We wouldn't have got that. So I think because we've not sold Smith Rowe at his peak and we have persisted and we've sent him out on loan, I think that fee is going to be quite low, to be honest with you. I would say probably about 25, 30 million. Looking at it from a PSR perspective, that comes up as pure profit on the books. And we know from January, as many journalists reported, that we were in a bit of a tight position. So if we're looking at making that sale, and of the limited players that we want to sell already, I think, unfortunately, he is probably one.
Sad story, isn't it?
Yeah.
But as a few people have pointed out in the chat, it does feel like it's just one of those where the way the circumstances played out and the way that everything happened just never really gave him a chance. It's a bit like when people talk about Zinchenko now and they say, you know, he was fantastic for us last year, particularly at the beginning of the season, really helped raise the level, but the project has moved past him. And that's another player actually that we could probably touch on as well. But sometimes a project develops and evolves and progresses. And the harsh reality of modern day football is that if you're injured at the time, you can miss the boat. And once you've missed the boat, it's very difficult to catch up. And I do feel like that is the situation with Emile Smith Rowe. We're going to move on to another player. We're going to talk after the break about Thomas Partey. Where does his future lay?
You're listening to the Chronicles of a Gooner. Like and subscribe.
You heard the man. Like and subscribe. Mike, let's get your thoughts on Thomas Partey. Lots of suggestions that he could be made available for a sale this summer. Obviously, only recently returned back to full fitness to the point where he's able to start games for us week in, week out. But my God, we've really missed him. When you watch him strutting his stuff and sort of strolling around the pitch, dictating things and pulling strings, it really does make you wonder what might have been had he been fit.
Yeah, I mean, I think with him, it's the sort of simplicity of it all and how he makes it look so easy. The way he just, like, it's things where, what was it, against Chelsea, and it was that dummy to sell Moises Caicedo. Things like that where it's just like, he doesn't even touch the ball, but what he does for the team is so sort of understated. And that's just a player with huge experience, and we've definitely lacked it, definitely. On the ball as well, I mean, you know, some of the passes that he shoots through midfields and defences to when breaking down low blocks is absolutely massive. And I think the biggest thing really, and you touched on this earlier, is just freeing up Declan Rice, because I think we heard when we first signed Declan Rice that we wanted him to play slightly further forward, but circumstances dictated that he was pushed back. And I think we've seen the best of Declan Rice in recent weeks when he's been able to operate in that number eight position and push up higher and be a threat on goal. So I think there's a lot of elements there that Partey has contributed to. But, you know, touch on the injuries. I've got the stats in front of me since we signed him. In terms of starts, 18 in his first season, 23 second season, 28 last season, which was his highest. And obviously that was been his best season for us. And then 7 this season. And, you know, when you look at players like William Saliba playing every minute for us and you compare it to someone like that is a player that we can rely on. Thomas Partey, unfortunately, is a player due to injuries that we can't rely on. So, you know, it is difficult, but, and he's not a player that we're really going to get a fee for. So if you're looking at it from, you know, start, bench or sell, I think probably bench, because I think he can be useful in certain games. But for me, I would want a more reliable number 6 to come in, be a starter and allow Declan Rice to play further up. But then, you know, it's sort of like the way Arteta's been able to handle things in recent months when he's had a fully fit squad is, you know, take it as a horses for courses approach and look at the opponent and say, OK, what do I need in this game and what does that player give me? Extra physicality, strength, you know, Thomas Partey, Declan Rice. You want a bit more sort of finesse, shorter passing, Jorginho. So I think having that option is really important.
I would keep Thomas Partey. I would keep him as, I say start, because he's good enough to start games for Arsenal Football Club. Because I think this idea that there are loads of Thomas Parteys out there is really kind of like far-fetched. I don't think there are many players in world football that can do what Thomas Partey can do. I think he's that good. I think his ability to progress the ball earlier than pretty much everybody else is so key, not just for what it gives our midfield, but the way it allows us to get onto back lines of opposition early and with enough time to cause damage, basically, before they get back in shape. So you think about those dummies that you've mentioned, the way he can sort of take the ball on the high half turn. I don't even think Declan Rice can do that. I don't think Declan Rice has the ability to do what Thomas Partey does and then work it to Saka or to Odegaard as early as he does. Because once those guys are getting the ball early, it's a game changer. Because all of a sudden, Bukayo Saka receives the ball when he's one-on-one with a fullback. You're not waiting and delaying it and allowing an opposition side to double up on Saka. You're getting him in those one-on-one situations. He isolates his fullbacks. And I don't think it's a coincidence whatsoever that Bukayo Saka and Martin Odegaard are playing their best football again now that Thomas Partey is back in the side. I'm not saying that they weren't good at any other point in the season, but I think his return has kind of coincided with a little bit of a boost from those guys as well. The fee point that you made, I think, is really important. Like, how much are you going to get for Thomas Partey? He's got 1 year left on his contract. He's got a very patchy injury record. He's not a young footballer. So I just look at it and I think, unless there is someone out there that you think is the one that's going to step into that role and replace him, and selling him allows you to do that deal, then I would keep hold of him. Because if you're talking about 10, 15, even 20 million pounds, is that going to move the needle in terms of you going out and getting his long-term replacement? Probably not. And I think if you manage him right, you might be able to get another season out of him.
Is there no one currently that you would look at realistically and say, okay, I think maybe he can do, right, not everything that Thomas Partey does, but maybe parts of his game, you know, talking about that ability to intercept and replay, but also, you know, progressive passing, maybe a bit more progressive than Declan Rice. Because I've seen like links, there's links to Martin Zubimendi. I think you did a video on him at some point, Harry. You watched him. Yeah. You know, I'm not saying him particularly, but someone like that who is younger, less injury prone, and can start most games. Because like that is always the thing, isn't it? Like, we're talking about him being useful, but as I just read out with the stats earlier, he's hardly there for the majority of the season, and that's not really what you need. So then, you know, you do need someone that's going to be able to play 30-35 games a season.
I look at other players and I think, yeah, there are players out there that can progress the ball, that can break lines nice and early, that could probably work the ball into Bukayo Saka and Martin Odegaard, as I've explained, that a little bit earlier than most. But where I always struggle is to find someone who can do that, but is also physically imposing enough to be the guy that sits at the base of your midfield and pulls the strings from there. I mean, think about Jorginho, right? I look at Jorginho, great passer of the ball, really intelligent. I've got no issue with anything that Jorginho does in possession, but he doesn't have the physicality to go with the intelligence that he has, because if he did, he'd be the best midfield player in the world or one of. Thomas Partey, the reason I think that when he is fit, and I know it's a very rare event these days, that he's at peak condition for a long period of time, I think he ticks all of the boxes. And because he ticks all of the boxes, I think that makes him a really, really kind of rare breed of midfield player. And I've heard people say Fofana. I haven't seen that much of him. I've heard people say Onana. We're getting that one in the comments as well. Amadou Onana of Everton. For me, he's not anywhere near the technical level of Thomas Partey. Physically, he might be. But technical side is lacking with regards to that particular player.
What about Bruno?
Bruno Guimaraes, I think he's probably one of the few players that you would say, yeah, you know, let's have a look at him. But think about what Newcastle United are going to want for him. Is that a realistic deal that we could do this summer? And if it's not, and you can't get anyone better than Thomas Partey, then that's probably why I come to the conclusion that we should keep him, because he is good enough to start. And if he's a bench option that comes in and out, I'm fine with that too. As you said, horses for courses.
I think one of our Newcastle writers has reported that Bruno Guimarães has got a release clause that activates at the end of May, I think, and that's about 100 million. So you're going to be spending a lot. And I think the thing with that is that, do you see that as a priority position? And because, you know, 100 million is a lot of money, especially when you consider that there might be other areas of the team that we want to and need to strengthen. Is that the kind of, you know, investment you want to make? Because that's Declan Rice money. And, you know, I don't think Bruno Guimarães personally is going to have a similar impact to what Declan Rice has had. I think it's going to be really difficult to match that. But then it's like you're spending 200 million on players in that play, you know, roughly the same position. So, yeah, I'm happy I'm not making the decisions at Arsenal. But yeah, it's an interesting one for sure, because I think, you know, Jorginho extending, he's obviously going to stay. We've got Declan Rice. We've got Sambi Lokonga, who we need to think about what we're going to do with him when he comes back from his loan. So we've got quite a few players, Thomas Partey as well, quite a few players in that position to make some big decisions. And, you know, I'm still not 100% sure whether, you know, we talk about, oh, Arsenal wanting Declan Rice to play number eight. I mean, we're just sort of assuming that. We're not actually sure. Maybe they might decide, oh, actually, we'll keep him at number six and sign a more attacking number eight. We just don't know. So, yeah, there's a lot of things to consider here, I think.
For sure. The next player I want to focus on is a player that you were a huge advocate of us going out to sign. You said it, to your credit, long before we heard anything about Arsenal being linked with this particular player. But in the end, they went out and got him for around about £50 million. Started his Arsenal career like a house on fire. Brilliant. Never going to be the lethal goal scorer that people maybe expected him to be. Previous evidence told us that right from the very beginning. But his impact on raising the level of this team when he came in, and his impact in terms of bringing the best out of those around him, was clear for everybody to see up until the World Cup, where he went, suffered an injury, came back, and I would argue has never quite been the same since. Gabriel Jesus, where are you on this one? Because I love the player, I adore the player, but I've been very clear on this podcast in recent weeks. I'll just quickly say what I'm going to say, because it's only literally two lines. I want him to stay, but if the right offer comes in, I think because of all the ongoing issues, you probably have to consider it. So he'd be sell for me if the price was right, but I'm also happy for him to be in the bench category or in the start category, because I think he's that good of a footballer. So this is a tough one. I'm going to throw it across to you, Gabriel Jesus.
So you've not answered the question, basically.
Nope. I ask the questions, you answer.
Fair enough. I think this one is really tricky because, you know, open to offers, that doesn't mean they're going to come in, you know. And I think
exactly
with the injury issues that he's had, it's going to be a big risk for teams who want to take him. And when he is on form, he is spectacular. But I still think with Jesus, like, take the injury issue out of it, and we're looking at someone who we either want to start or sell. Like, just remove the bench factor. I still think that we need a bit of an upgrade. Like, because even in form, Jesus, who was like incredible in and around the box, I still think he misses chances. And I think when you don't have that sort of out and out goal scorer, you rely on other players to pick up on that front. And I know this season, you know, we've scored more goals than last season, and we have clicked in attack. I still think that we could do with someone in an ideal world, obviously fantasy land, we could do with someone on the left hand side that is versatile and can play up front as well. So I'm looking at someone like Alexander Isak that can score goals and can guarantee goals playing either up front or on the left. So in my ideal world, I would prefer to, you know, get a decent offer for Jesus and then spend that money on someone like Isak, Ollie Watkins, someone like that. I know that's incredibly unrealistic. But I'm with you. Like, Jesus, I absolutely love him. I think he did great work with Zinchenko in transforming us. It was a mentality thing, but also just that quality and that sort of... So I remember coming on this channel, Harry, and when we had Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Alexandre Lacazette, and I always said, if we could only combine the two, you know, if we could have Lacazette's link-up play and hold-up play with Aubameyang's finishing, I felt like we were onto a winner. And with Jesus, I kind of saw that in the early stages. But then, you know, after the injury, he just hasn't been the same. But I think he was right for us at the time. But moving forward and, you know, how Arteta's used Havertz, which I think has been a real revolution, because I just think Havertz offers us that horses for courses approach where, you know, I was watching Match of the Day and I was laughing watching Spurs because it was so funny seeing them trying to play the ball out the back and just get caught up the pitch. If they could have a Kai Havertz up front and, you know, Ange said to Vicario, why don't you just, you know, boot it up there and your striker can hold it up. Having that option is so big for us. We need to take that into account. And I think Jesus doesn't offer us that as well. So I know I'm going round and round in circles here, but I agree with you. If an offer comes in for Jesus, I think you take it. But whether that comes in, I don't know.
See, I don't think an offer that I would deem acceptable is going to come in because of all the issues that he's got with the knee. It's well publicized that it's an ongoing problem. What is the number at which you would do a deal? Because for me, the number is probably £35 million, given that we paid 50 for him. I think if someone came in and said, here's £35 million now or at the end of a loan period and it was guaranteed, I would do that. I would take that. But I'm happy for him to come in and out of the side, play on the right flank when Saka needs a rest, play on, even if he plays on the left sometimes. Like, I don't think he's as effective from the left as he is from the right. And I think there are far worse backup centre forwards in world football than Gabriel Jesus. But I just think, again, a bit like when we were talking about Smith Rowe, the project has accelerated. And you're right in that Havertz has shown us that actually someone with a lot more sort of angles to his game can make the world of difference. You're right. When we're being pressed, if we want to go long, we can do that. If we're struggling to break someone down, we can now hang crosses up at the far post and trust him to get on the end of it. And what the other thing that really jumps out at me in terms of the differences between Havertz and Jesus is that we all used to say that the reason Jesus couldn't get into the 6-yard box and score the tap-ins, if you like, or get on the end of things was because he was too busy getting involved in the build-up outside the box, to the left of the box, to the right of the box. Kai Havertz does all of those things and he still pops up in the box when you need him to, which shows that it is doable. And it is possible if you're really, really performing at a high level. And unfortunately for Gabriel Jesus, he's just not there at the minute.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. And he's never been a lethal finisher. I mean, we saw that, you know, we've seen that across his career and even before the injury. That's just not his game. But I think one of his best games recently was against Man City in the home game at the Emirates. And he played right wing. I thought he was unbelievable. Because, you know, I think Pep said he's one of the best defensive forwards in the world because he's so hardworking. He's so switched on and intelligent. He just gives you something that not a lot of attackers do. So I do see the benefits of keeping him. But if we're talking about evolving and moving on and, you know, signing that striker slash winger that I would like, I think we probably need to cash in. So in terms of a number, I mean, it does feel quite low, but maybe you take 25 million, you know, you take half of what you paid. And then, you know, that helps us out in a PSR sense, and put that towards a player that is going to really help us move on. Cause I think he will be really, really good as a bench option, but then it's like, and I'm not saying it exactly works like this cause it's not Football Manager, but do you maybe sacrifice a bench option to then, you know, put that towards having a more complete player that you want for the attack?
Yeah, I think the big factor is as well, it's not just about what you'd get in for him transfer fee. He's obviously someone that's a really high earner at Arsenal Football Club.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're talking about paving the way for new players or improved players to come in, you have to factor that in as well. You know, can you justify having somebody like Gabby Jesus, who we think, going by the rumors and reports, is on around about 300, 350 grand a week? Can you justify that spend on a player's salary who isn't a key part of your starting 11? And the answer to that is probably no, not really. So that's another facet to it, I guess. Let's talk Fabio Vieira. I don't know where I'm at with this guy, Mike. There are times when I watch him and I think, you are a really technically gifted and talented football player, but you're maybe lacking something physically. And then people tell me, well, he's working on it, he's bulking up. And then I've seen him from time to time look a little bit better in that sense. I did get the feeling earlier on in this season that this was kind of going to be his season, in terms of the season where we all kind of, I'm not saying he was going to be a starter week in, week out, but I thought it was going to be the season where he proved to everybody that actually he's got something to offer to this team. And then he picked up that injury, which saw him ruled out for a long period of time. And he's never been able to work his way back in the side, or even close to that since. Where are you on Fabio Vieira?
I think I've still kind of got the same concern that I had when we first signed him, is that he's too lightweight. I think if you're going to play in a midfield position, which he does primarily, like we're talking about with Emil Smith-Rowe, you need the technical ability, but you also need the physicality and the defensive game. And I just don't think he has that. And when I look at players of his sort of stature that I look at and think, okay, well, you can kind of get away with it because you're so technically gifted. Like, I'm thinking about Santi Cazorla, who, you know, often played as the sort of second deepest midfielder in a pivot. I'm thinking about Bernardo Silva. And the reason that they can get away with being that stature and height, I mean, Santi Cazorla maybe is a bit different because he was slightly stockier, you know, as hard as push off the ball.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bernardo Silva is so slight, but he's so technically good. He's so versatile. He can play right wing. He's played left back for Pep. He's played central midfield. And he's of that ilk that you can get away with it. I don't think Vieira is there. And ideally, the position that we want him to play is as probably the right number eight, would you say, like to cover for Martin Odegaard? I think if Martin Odegaard comes out of that team at any point, we are half the team that we are. And ultimately, that's what you want him to do. You want him to be that central midfielder that's box to box, that's, you know, leading the press, that's doing all of them things. And I just don't think Vieira can do that. I mean, again, we're talking about a money situation. Are we going to get money back for a player that's, you know, not really featured this season, was sporadic last season? I don't know. But yeah, not for me. I think I've never really been convinced by him. He's not quite done enough to convince me.
So you're saying sell?
Yeah, sell, yeah. Yeah.
Sell. Yeah. I kind of feel that way too. When it comes to Fabio Vieira, as I say, I think I've seen glimpses of what he can do, and I can understand why Arsenal thought that he's a player that they should, you know, bring to the football club and someone that they could develop over time. But he's not a kid. Like, he's not an 18-year-old. He's not a 20-year-old. He's not someone I look at and think, okay, well, you're still kind of getting there. You're developing. I think if you're not good enough at this age, the likelihood is that you're probably never going to be at the level that we want you to be. And listen, this is not a massive criticism of Arsenal, because there isn't a football club in the world that doesn't have misses when it comes to signings. It happens. I think the problem that some football clubs have is that they become almost obsessed with trying to make some of those signings work when there's clearly no chance of that happening. And then you can stick with people and persist with people for too long. I think, again, falls into that category of if the right offer comes in. And the price point on Vieira for me is far lower than it would be for Gabriel Jesus. I would go as far as saying, if someone came in with a 15 to 20 million pounds offer, I'd bite their hands off and let him go. And I don't think he will want to stick around, Mike. You know, he's come from Porto, where he was playing regularly, to Arsenal. And the real difficulty for a lot of these players is that the situation at Arsenal is what it is, right? You're not going to break into Martin Odegaard's position. And you're not going to take Bukayo Saka's position. You're not going to take Gabriel Martinelli's position. The only person in the team that can do that is Leandro Trossard. And so where do you fit in? Because again, it goes back to the point I was making earlier. You can't have too lightweight of a midfield. So Vieira is one who I think doesn't really know where his home is in this team and is going to have a lot of the same issues that Emile Smith Rowe does and has had in the past. Let's take it on to Jakub Kivior. If you'd have asked me this earlier in the season, my view would have been quite different. He's then come into the team and done quite well at times, playing at left back, which I still don't believe is his position, by the way. But in terms of the way he's come on, he has progressed. He has advanced. He has, I think, settled into the group a little bit better. And I think he's got to grips with Premier League football a lot more now. This is one for me that I'm not saying will be a starter, but given his ability to play in different defensive positions, I think is a really worthwhile asset and someone that we should probably keep a hold of right now. Are you convinced by the Polish international?
Overall, I've got to be honest. No, I get, you know, I see the plus points and I see that how our game has changed. Because, you know, typically it would have been Zinchenko playing left back and he stepped into midfield and we kind of realized that we needed a bit more stability on the left-hand side. So we opted for Kivior and it did kind of work. But, and maybe it's too harsh, but I get flashbacks of Leroy Sané just destroying him down the left and thinking at the time, he's just not at this level. And that might sound harsh, but, you know, Champions League quarterfinal against Bayern Munich and he just wasn't there. I'm not saying he can't get there, but for where we are at this moment in time, I can't see him getting into the team ahead of Yuri and Timber next year. Assuming that's the position we think he's going to play.
Let me frame it this way for you. When Kivior first came into the side and people were looking at him and going, this guy is not a left back. What on earth are we doing? I sat and thought about this at length because I'm sad and I've got nothing better to do. But the conclusion I came to was that actually the reason Kivior came into the team in the first place was obviously because of injuries at left back we're talking about. And there was a point where he was the fourth choice left back in this side. Because had everybody been fit, Zinchenko would have been ahead of him, Tomiyasu would have been ahead of him, and Timber would have been ahead of him. Mm-hmm. So do we need to cut him some slack with regards to his performances at left fullback, given that he was probably the fourth in line for that position? This wasn't, you know, someone that we'd signed to come in as a left back struggling to perform in that position. And I don't think we've seen enough of him at centre back to really make a judgment. So that's why I'm kind of leaning towards bench rather than sell or start at the minute.
So are you thinking more towards he's back up for Gabriel rather than back up at left back? Because if you've got Timber and Tomiyasu, let's just say, you know, we do move on from Zinchenko at some point. Yeah, I mean, again, like I'm not sure we've seen enough of him at centre back. And when I have seen him there, you know, he's done fine. Like for me, he's just fine. He's not really ever impressed me. I think he's done a decent job. That Bayern Munich game, you know, it might be harsh to single him out for that. He's up against a, you know, a world-class winger who I'm sure would cause a lot of defenders problems. But yeah, he's just, for me, he's not an outstanding player. And again, he's not one that's super young. What is he, 23, 24? I think, you know, if we could dip into the market and sign a Jarrell Hatto, for instance, someone who can play left back with who's got more upside is younger. I would say do it probably. And, you know, maybe that's harsh to Kivior, but I don't think I've seen enough to say, yes, you know, he's our backup. And say Gabriel got injured for 4 months of the season, I wouldn't be completely confident throwing him in there. I think that partnership looks a bit shaky. I mean, also just saying that, thinking about what would happen if William Saliba got injured, I worry about that even more because I genuinely don't know who would play centre-back if Saliba got injured.
I think that as outstanding a player as William Saliba is, I think we're much better covered at right centre back, because you could always tuck Ben White in there and play Tomiyasu at right back. You could put Tomiyasu at right centre back. You could put Timber at right centre back if you needed to. But it's the left side where we have a problem. And I think when you like to play out from the back the way that we do, although in the past we've seen lots of right-footed centre-backs play on the left side of their centre-back pairing and do a really good job. John Terry's the one that always springs to mind. Sol Campbell, I'm pretty sure. Was it Sol Campbell or Kolo Touré? One of them played on the left side of that back four in terms of the centre-back pairing, and they were both right-footed players. So I think in the past that was fine. But now that you're asking people to build up from the back, and the angles are really important with regards to how you distribute the ball and move it forward, I think that left centre back is a much bigger issue for us. That's just my opinion on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's such an important position though, Harry. Like, I mean, like, look at, you know, Man City obviously have got so much money. But look at the centre backs they had last season, you know, and they've added to that. Akanji, Ruben Diaz, Laporte was there last season, John Stones, Gvardiol they've added. Like, obviously it is a key position. And if we're going to, you know, because when Kivior plays, we basically play four centre-backs on the back line. You know, Tomiyasu has played there before. I think when it's such a key position, you need to be able to throw players in for long periods if players ahead of them get injured. And I'm not completely convinced by Kivior how he'd do in a sustained period. I mean, I've not seen him enough at centre back, and I think he's going to be down the pecking order at left back. So it's not particularly on him saying that he's a bad player or anything, but I think in those sorts of situations, I would prefer someone like I mentioned, Hatto,
yeah,
who we can develop and has got a bit of a higher ceiling. But you know, again, this isn't Football Manager, so it doesn't always work out like that. So if you're asking me Kivior, I mean, there's no point selling him really, because I think he's fine, as I've said, and also I don't think he command a big fee.
Agreed.
So keep on him.
Okay. We weren't going to do this player, but when we were talking, it just kind of came to my mind, and I feel like now that I've said that, it would be wrong if we just kind of skipped over him. Just finally, very quickly, Oleksandr Zinchenko. This is a classic example of what we've been talking about really throughout this show. Player comes in, takes the world by storm, really improves your team. But then shortly afterwards, as your team evolves and as you get into situations where you're then competing with the big boys, you can see that he's not quite at the level with one particular aspect of his game. And that is obviously the defensive side. And when you're a left back, that is a pretty big problem. So I'm of the opinion now that if, again, a bit like Gabriel Jesus, and this is really harsh because last season those two guys came in and turned our world upside down. But this is the reality of top-level football. It's a very harsh business. If a right offer came in for Oleksandr Zinchenko, given that Mikel Arteta, as you rightly highlighted, likes to play with centre-backs at full-back, he's probably one that you should consider selling. I don't know what your take is on this.
Yeah, I think if we're talking about Tomiyasu and Timber being the front two choices at left back, I don't really think you can afford to keep Zinchenko as a was talking about third choice left back. As you say, I think he's been brilliant for this club. You know, he revolutionized the way we play. You know, we've never played with inverted fullbacks before. Harry, I remember talking on this podcast at one stage. We had Kieran Tierney, and he was our main attacking threat in the team. And we used use him as an overlapping left back, and that
cross it into the box to no one.
Cross it to no one. So you know, we're sitting here years later, and talking about a player who, you know, has won titles, is a top international. Great experience, and he revolutionized the way we play. But the big but is that you know, this project under Arteta is brutal. It evolves quickly. It moves with the trends. Like, Pep Guardiola has not stayed as one of the best managers in the world because he's kept doing the same thing. He's constantly tried to make tweaks, look at things differently, see how this player can be used to free up another player, or how can I break teams down, or how can I react to what teams are doing. And I think we've seen, you know, it was a pretty bad indictment for Zinchenko, and I don't know about the fitness situation at this point, but he picked Kivior over Zinchenko in the first leg of a quarterfinal against Bayern Munich. I mean, that pretty much tells you, you know, what you need to know about where he places Zinchenko in the pecking order. As I say, if they were both at sort of similar fitness at the time, I don't know that obviously, but I think we have slightly moved on from him. And I think it'll be sad because he's a great player to have around, but is it enough, that great player to have around factor, for the amount of money that he'd be on and maybe the fee that we could recoup for him? I don't know. I think as well, like just thinking about like how our build up has changed, I just think we've not only defensively, but I think we've kind of moved on from that. And I think he'd sort of like be operating similar spaces that Declan Rice would. And I just don't think we need him at this moment in time.
I don't disagree with any of that. The current or the common, I should say, pushback that I seem to get whenever I suggest that maybe it's time to move on from Zinchenko is, well, why don't we use him as a midfielder? And actually, in theory, I don't disagree with that, because when you think of what Zinchenko brings to the team, it's control, it's passing ability, it's vision, it's security in possession, all of those things, right? But Mikel Arteta has never gone down that route. He has never gone, you know what, we're short in midfield today, I'm going to put Zinchenko in there. Even to the point where he's been playing a centre forward in the eight position, rather than picking Zinchenko there. I think he played there once for about 20 minutes in one game, because it was a kind of in-game situation that developed, and that was what Mikel Arteta decided to do. But whilst I don't disagree with the theory of Zinchenko being utilised as a midfielder and how effective that may or may not be, I just can't see it happening, because we've got no evidence to suggest that that is even in Mikel Arteta's thinking. So I think we're agreed that Zinchenko is probably one that if we could sell on this summer, we should probably look to do so. Michael, thank you very, very much for joining me as always. Let everybody know how they can follow you, where they can listen to your fantastic podcasts as well, and basically just give yourself a plug.
Yeah, so on Twitter, @Mike_Stavrou, regularly retweet podcasts that I produce on a range of things, loads of different clubs, Arsenal as well sometimes. So yeah, check it out.
Make sure you give him a follow. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast that Mike produces over on The Athletic. It is very, very good. It's the best in the business. Lots of experts on it all the time. Io hosts it as well, doesn't he? He's fantastic as well. A good friend. And it's great to see him and Mike doing well on this big podcast platform. So congratulations to you both. While you're at it, make sure that you're subscribed to this podcast as well on whichever platform it is that you prefer to listen to it from. If you're watching us on YouTube, why on earth haven't you left a like on the video? We've not even hit 100 likes, but there's more than enough of you, I should say, to hit that target quite easily. We should hit way more than that. But if we could make sure that we get to at least 100 by the time we sign out, I'd be very, very grateful. Subscribe to the channel as well. Check out the channel update that we put out yesterday. You can find it on the YouTube channel or in your podcast feed if you are a listener. And visit our Patreon page, which you can even join for free over the course of the summer if you fancy trying before you buy. But a massive thank you to everybody that has already signed up and made a pledge to the podcast, because I didn't expect so many of you to show support in the way that you have. If you don't want to do that and can't do that, no hard feelings. But if you could support me by leaving likes, reviews, and clicking the subscribe button, that's also very, very helpful. Mike, thank you so, so much. We'll be back very, very soon with more. Until the next one, take care of yourselves. Have a great evening. Goodbye.